Simon Williams, the RAC fuel spokesperson, said, "News that fuel prices have bottomed out and are now on the rise again is bad news for British drivers, and possibly the economy and future inflation rates too. While we're not expecting prices to shoot up dramatically, it appears that oil is trading up, which in the absence of a stronger pound means wholesale fuel cuts, more for retailers to buy in. The result is higher prices at the petrol pump for motorists, and more expense for the everyday driver. The RAC does not expect forecourt prices to climb much higher, but a lot depends on how much margin the biggest retailers decide to take," he said. "Supermarket margins are lower than they were in January, but they are still significantly higher than they were prior to the pandemic and to the Russia-Ukraine war. British retailers have faced scrutiny over how quickly they pass on rises and falls in the wholesale price of fuel onto the customer. Last year, the government accused station owners of treating motorists as cash cows. To remedy the situation, it is forcing companies to provide live pricing data, allowing drivers to shop around more easily for the best deals available." The Bloomberg News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Petrol and diesel prices at Britain's forecourts have jumped more than 2% in recent weeks, according to data from the RAC motoring organisation. The gains have been triggered by the higher cost of oil internationally, which has been trading above $80 a barrel for most of the last 4 weeks. The Houthi fighters in Yemen have attacked ships in the Red Sea area and are forcing tankers to avoid the Suez Canal and instead sail around South Africa's Cape of Good Hope, increasing the journey considerably. From 29th of January to 18th of February, unleaded gasoline jumped by 3.2 pence a litre to 143.4 pence a litre, while diesel prices rose from 148 pence a litre to 152 pence a litre. Maintenance at oil refineries around the world is also supporting petrol prices, according to RAC's fuel spokesman, Simon Williams. Simon Williams added, "We ought not to see forecourt prices go up too much more from where they are today, but a lot depends on how much margin the biggest retailers decide to take for themselves."
Hello and welcome to our program. I'm your host, Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh. Today, we go face to face with the head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mr. Mohammad Islami, as we talk about the different fields where Iran has made significant advancements in when it comes to nuclear science and technology, and also talk about some of the double standards that the UN nuclear watchdog has been using when it comes to its attitude towards the Islamic Republic of Iran and see where it originates from. So stay tuned. Mr. Mohammad Islami, thank you for joining the program.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
We are as well. So let's first talk about the document for the 20-year nuclear technology vision that we have. Can you tell me about what goals are set in that document?
Indeed, in the name of Allah, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful. Every organization naturally needs a vision, a defined plan within a specific time frame, outlining goals, policies, and strategies based on studies of actual conditions, aligning the organization's movement with those very directions. By divine grace, we managed to formulate the document for the 20-year vision of nuclear technology, with the participation of all relevant parties, leading to the recognition of the industry's potential impact on all dimensions of people's lives and the modern economy. This was well received by all relevant bodies within the Islamic Republic of Iran's administration and establishment, and we were able to have the document unveiled by the president after going through all the stages of approval. In the middle of the last Persian calendar year, when this document was unveiled, the entire organization's movement was aligned with the path laid by the document. We are currently progressing along this path with five primary goals in mind. Firstly, the process of nuclear fuel supply and necessary activities within the industrial chain and testing in the fuel process. Our aim is to complete and reach the capacity necessary to cover the required objectives outlined in the document. This was an effective step, indicating our utilization of diverse resources, allowing our fuel cycle to become a comprehensive, sustainable industry capable of expansion. We are progressing in this direction. The second pillar was clean and sustainable energy. Climate change is a serious global concern, with a net zero carbon emission target set for 2050. Naturally, our country, being highly vulnerable to climate change, has strongly emphasized the goal of producing clean and sustainable energy. We have included the objective of generating 20,000 megawatts of new nuclear power in this vision document, requiring comprehensive scientific and industrial research efforts to achieve this goal. The third pillar observed in this process was the development of the nuclear industry in the medical and health sector. In the medical and health domain, we target expanding the capacity for producing radiopharmaceuticals in order to become a global player and a consistent innovator at the forefront. We aim to benefit from the nuclear industry in producing radioisotopes, radiopharmaceuticals, especially novel radioisotopes, and radiopharmaceuticals, and this too is a focal point of the industry. The fourth focus is the development of irradiation applications and protection against contamination. In a real sense, two extensive steps are dedicated to ensuring food security and community health. We utilize irradiation to sterilize agricultural products. In our country, which annually produces around 130 million tons of agricultural goods, this process helps eliminate toxins and pests and extends their shelf life. This, in turn, contributes to national economic prosperity, supports businesses in this domain, and boosts household economies. Additionally, protection against radiation contamination is crucial. Accordingly, the Safety Protection Center is slated to evolve into a more efficient state institution, capable of appropriately fulfilling its legal duty of radiation protection. The fifth pillar of the vision document concerns human resources. We require effective human resources. Our approach to industrial research and development involves considering the development of human resources and scientific advancement. This pillar includes R&D projects at the forefront of knowledge aimed at practical flourishing, technological attainment, streamlining the innovation cycle from idea to product, and simultaneously ensuring the necessary workforce for the present and future of the organization. These were the five fundamental chapters observed in the vision document.
Right, so let's go over each of these points one by one. So the first one was the procurement of the nuclear fuel for the reactors. Let's talk about the process of getting there. So from the excavation of uranium-235 to the utilization of uranium-235. How much of this process is domesticized, and where are we in reaching that goal we have in the 20-year vision?
Clearly, we're one of the countries significantly affected by unjust double standards. Due to nuclear sanctions, there has been no cooperation provided to us in our nuclear sector. Hence, all our processes in research are directed toward anticipated results, utilizing our research capabilities, specifically tailored to yield technological products, especially nuclear fuel. Today, we possess a sustainable capacity for our required fuel, aiming to independently design, construct, and operate power plants, needing critical fuel, and ultimately operating them with Iranian-made fuel.
So let's go over the second point that you mentioned with regards to the goals of the IAEA. According to the recent remarks by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, he said that reaching that 20,000 megawatts of power generated through these nuclear power plants is crucial for the 20-year vision. Where are we along the path of reaching that 20,000 megawatts?
We've designed an operation plan for this 20,000 megawatts. Based on studies conducted in Iran by Westerners over the past 50 years for establishing nuclear power plants, which we updated, we identified regions and established companies for achieving the 20,000 megawatt target by setting up and operating nuclear power generation plants. These companies primarily function along the southern coasts, with one also situated in the northern coastal area, conducting in-depth environmental and geological studies. One of these companies, ahead in its environmental geological data, has progressed to the stage of ordering equipment and initiating operational activities at its site. Therefore, every 20,000 megawatt capacity has been divided into five different regions, each of them in a different phase of operation within the program, and each is in motion.
The third point was the usage of nuclear science and technology in the medical field. So there are, of course, different areas where you can tackle medical sciences using nuclear sciences. For example, let's talk about using plasma therapy and where we are in the world when it comes to our position, when it comes to plasma therapy, and what kind of cancers or different types of illnesses are we targeting with it?
Currently, in the field of radioisotopes and radiopharmaceuticals, we've reached operational capacity with about 50 radiopharmaceuticals used in diagnostic, palliative, and therapeutic areas. Approximately 1 million individuals in the country benefit from these medical services and radiopharmaceuticals annually. Importantly, we're expanding our capacity in this realm, both qualitatively and quantitatively. Qualitatively, we aim for higher precision in diagnostic radioisotopes to aid medical professionals in better diagnosis. And quantitatively, we're striving to enhance their effectiveness, especially for therapeutic radiopharmaceuticals. Currently, we have 13 new radiopharmaceuticals undergoing critical trials, progressing along this path. Parallel to the discussion on radiopharmaceuticals is plasma therapy. We've dedicated efforts to plasma therapy over the past 2 years. Currently, the clinical trial phase involves using plasma for treating non-healing wounds, particularly in diabetic patients. Another clinical phase is plasma therapy for cancer treatment, currently being used in operating rooms. We're expanding plasma therapy utilization for its significant potential in combating cancer, and we're actively pursuing this goal.
Now, before I touch on the fourth point, one of the goals of the IAEA has been to implement the usage of smaller scale reactors. I want to know about the reason behind that and how far along we are in implementing and reaching that goal that we want to.
Look, the objective outlined by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and the Global Pursuit, particularly in the recent COP28 summit in Abu Dhabi, where countries pledged to triple their nuclear power capacities, aims at carbon emission reduction. Carbon emission reduction is attainable through increased nuclear power plant capacity. However, not all countries or locations can accommodate large-scale nuclear plants. Hence, research into miniature technology has been underway. This aims to design and build small-scale, widely distributed nuclear power plants in various countries, facilitating the pursuit of the 2050 net-zero carbon emission goal. Because nuclear power plants' efficiency is often over 93% to 95%, unlike other power plants with significantly lower efficiency, the stability and cleanliness of this energy emphasizes accelerating this IAEA-defined goal through scientific and engineering endeavors.
Now, the fourth goal that you mentioned for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran was the usage of irradiation and the tools that we use to protect the operators from irradiation when they're working in, like, for example, reactors and the radioisotope making. So can you tell us about some of the different tools that we have been able to make? For example, there are the measurement tools, the precision tools that we have made, and also the contamination monitors, and also some of the usages of the irradiation, different irradiation devices that we have made.
There were two important aspects in your question that I want to address. Firstly, in the field of radioisotopes, one rapidly expanding aspect globally is the nuclear measurement system, nuclear instrumentation used in advanced industries. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran has introduced these systems, and today we have complete mastery of advanced versions of these nuclear instrumentation systems and design, and we produce and provide support for them for various industries in the country. This is one aspect. The second aspect regarding irradiation exposure involves our radiation-generating systems. We have designed cyclotrons and gamma irradiation systems, both pool-type and self-shielded types. We have incorporated these into our agenda to design these systems, procure the required irradiation sources, and through studies conducted for the country's needs, implement these across all production centers, be it industrial or agricultural products, suitable for irradiation. Over a 3-year plan, God willing, will establish these to enable products to undergo radiation exposure, creating high added value financially and economically. Most importantly, this contributes to food security and public health. Irradiation not only increases productivity and efficiency, but also enhances safety and health for the people. Another critical point is our capability to provide various educational accelerators and research tools, similar to those in nuclear power plants. You'll find similar simulations, just like the one behind us, in the control rooms of Bushehr Nuclear Power Plant. These simulations serve educational purposes in universities and even in power plants for operational training. These systems, in line with research and human resource development in the fifth pillar that I mentioned, are designed, built, and made available to target centers.
Now, in the process of making all these radioisotopes or these precision tools, the density measurement tools and whatnot, and making of these radiopharmaceuticals, one crucial point, especially when it comes to the reactors and where the radioisotopes are made, is the usage of heavy water and light water. So we consume and produce a lot of both of these two types of waters, and I would assume there's a level of exporting that we do for these light and heavy waters. So what is our place globally when it comes to the exports and the demand that there is for our light and heavy water?
This is a very important issue. Our organization is a key player globally as a producer of heavy water, holding a sustainable share in the international market. Our capacity stands out significantly compared to our competitors due to its quality. What's important for us is not just the heavy water used in reactors, but also its derivatives, approximately 230 types, which find utility across various industries, particularly in pharmaceuticals, especially medications based on deuterium. We're following this path and are thankful that through the efforts of our young scientists and researchers, we have achieved this global standard. We're currently expanding and enhancing the capabilities and the efficiency of these products.
So we're right now at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and perhaps the most important parts of this whole facility, this whole area, is the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Center. What is the goal, the main goal, of this Nuclear Science and Technology Research Center?
Relentless movement towards progress serves as the goal of our research sector. This allows us to stay on the path at the forefront of knowledge, utilize our findings through articles and commercialization of technologies to serve humanity, and expand them. Our distinction from advanced countries when it comes to new sciences and technologies lies in our dedication to serving humanity and sustainability of peace. We don't impose control, but engage with all countries with the aim of making these technologies available to them. Therefore, our research direction aims to remain at the forefront of knowledge and relentlessly pursue new findings.
So a major part of the research side of things happens right here. But how does this research and the results that come out of it get implemented into industries? What does the path look like, and where do knowledge-based companies play a part along this path?
The knowledge-based companies born out of this research stream are technological developers. We undertake the risks associated with these new technologies initially to the extent where risks are minimized, enabling other companies and industries to utilize them. The research flow and the technology development stream in the Atomic Energy Organization is being handled within a knowledge-based network. We have introduced open project policies and innovation, intending to utilize all capacities in the process of transforming knowledge into technology and industry. Our perspective is international, and that's why next year, on the 50th anniversary of the Atomic Energy Organization's establishment, we're organizing the first international nuclear conference in Iran, welcoming various countries and the agency. Our inaugural conference carries the message of peaceful nuclear technology for everyone and nuclear weapons for no one. In this regard, we're pleased that through an international initiative next year, we'll be the initiators of an active movement to promote nuclear sciences and technologies globally.
Now let's get a more in-depth look at one of these nuclear power plants and see what it is actually capable of. So for instance, the Bushehr nuclear power plant, what is the capacity of its power production, and what can we expect from it in the future?
The power plant number one in Bushehr is a facility with a nominal capacity of 1,025 megawatts. This power plant, in the year of 2023, has completed its 10th year of operation. To date, it has injected over 62 billion kilowatt hours of electricity into our national grid, preventing the emission of over 90 million cubic meters of greenhouse gases and saving approximately 90 million barrels of oil. This demonstrates Iran's commitment to clean energy. We're addressing a lag in the construction of power plants by expediting the implementation of units 2 and 3 in the Bushehr power plant, currently under construction. Our endeavor in executing the 20,000 megawatt plan is to showcase ourselves as prominent players in the global field of atomic power plant design and construction. It's a response to the political turmoil and psychological security measures that have been fabricated against Iran's nuclear program, which are entirely false and baseless. We operate transparently and under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, extending our nuclear activities for peace and security.
So the Bushehr facility is a nuclear power plant. Over here, in this facility, we have a research reactor. What are the other research reactors or power plants that we can expect in the future to be made?
We currently have two research reactors that are being designed and constructed. One is a 20-megawatt research reactor, and the other is a 10-megawatt research reactor. Additionally, we have a zero-power research reactor intended for educational and research purposes in the design and construction phase. These three projects constitute our research backbone, supporting our national education and the production of various radioisotopes required in the medical and industrial sectors.
So the next subject would be nuclear fusion technology. It's, to my understanding, the next step for us. So where are we along the path of reaching the technology to be able to use nuclear fusion and the power that we get from that?
This is a very important point. Nuclear fusion is the future, particularly when it comes to achieving clean, sustainable energy. and it is being pursued collectively and individually by nations. In our country, within the Atomic Energy Organization, one of our key and fundamental projects is the nuclear fusion project. Utilizing all scientific and research elements that can assist the organization and participate in the projects, we have initiated these plans with the goal of creating a tokamak with a designated scale. Hopefully, we can present our research findings.
So, why even is it the future step? Why is nuclear fusion technology more difficult to achieve, and how do you compare the power or the usage that we get out of nuclear fusion compared to the nuclear fission reactors that we already have?
It's evident that this path is both challenging and costly, involving time-consuming and expansive research efforts. All nations involving in this matter are working towards maintaining sustainable energy. No one casts an economic view on this matter. Everyone is working on it with a scientific and research-oriented approach. What matters is the existence of this activity, regardless of the scale or duration of the energy derived from nuclear fusion. The importance lies in mastering the processes, elements, and components to transform it into a system, be it projects carried out worldwide or aligned with the focus observed in France. We are continuing our efforts independently, aligning with those pursuits.
So let's stay on the topic of these international governing bodies, namely the IAEA. So the International Atomic Energy Agency has said in a recent report that Iran has increased its production of highly enriched uranium, to which you responded that there has been no change in our capacity for production. Do you think that the IAEA may be playing into the hands of the Zionist entity and their propaganda machine?
This is quite clear. Even in the instance where the Director General speaks and warns the world, saying, "Don't forget about Iran while your attention is on Gaza," it fuels Iranophobia, contrary to international norms and against the rights of a nation. We haven't engaged in any undisclosed activities for him to caution us like this or to remind us that we need JCPOA 2.0. These actions are adherence to requests that are made of them. We have always requested the Director General to uphold the agency's credibility as an international independent body, unaffected by political agenda. And we stated in a March 2023 statement addressing the agency that the framework of our activities are based on the IAEA safeguards and the NPT. Considering the remaining items, we will interact and define a modality for the remaining issues and in-between matters between the two parties. These three clauses exist. There is currently no discrepancy or non-compliance between us. Even regarding inspectors, the issue with the inspectors is an inherent right of any country and nation. According to Article 9, the agency must introduce inspectors to us. We evaluate the inspectors and express our opinion. This routinely happens. If we cancel a designee inspector or several inspectors, it's within the realm of inspections, and those inspectors hadn't even come to Iran in the first place. Then they portray it as if their inspectors were expelled. We didn't expel any inspectors. There haven't been any inspectors in Iran whom we expelled. There is a list, a roster, currently 125 inspectors, if I'm not mistaken, who are designees, meaning Iran has agreed for them to visit. However, not all of them necessarily come to Iran. So the excessive focus on Iran, the timely and untimely reports about Iran, is entirely contrary to norms. It's a double standard, and we strongly oppose this double standard. We have expressed our grievances to the agency and always expect the Director General to maintain that international credibility of the agency and not join the pressure group, the group consisting of three European countries that exert pressure on Iran, never align with them, and allow our relations to proceed naturally within the framework of the agreements and the NPT.
Mr. Islami, thank you very much for joining the program and for your time. Well, you heard about how the International Atomic Energy Agency has been adopting double standards with its approach to Iran and where it may be originating from. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. But that's not going to stop Iran's advancements in different fields of nuclear science and technology. That's going to be it for this edition of Face to Face.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A Zionist entrepreneur who participated in the genocide in Gaza has pitched a so-called plan to a European firm for the territory's future. The pitch reveals an underlying desire to conquer and control every inch of Palestine, including Gaza. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, a Zionist entrepreneur who participated in the genocide in Gaza has pitched a so-called plan to a European firm for the territory's future. The Gaza Strip, which the plan assumes would be conquered and controlled by the Zionist regime, would be divided into two zones. In the northern zone, Palestinian collaborators would be permitted to live in relative comfort, while those who refuse to serve and obey their Zionist masters would be banished to a southern area of terror. The Electronic Intifada has seen a copy of this so-called day-after plan. The pitch exposes the frightening colonial mindset and racist view of Palestinians pervasive in Israel. It also reveals an underlying desire to conquer and control every inch of Palestine, including Gaza. The plan was submitted by Or Bokazba, a Zionist reserve officer in the Sayeret Matkal Elite Commando Unit, who was deployed in Gaza for several weeks during October and November. Bokazba lives in New York City but was in Israel on October 7th when the Palestinian resistance group Hamas led a military operation that destroyed the Zionist regime army's Gaza division, which is responsible for enforcing the Zionist regime's siege on the territory. Bokazba immediately reported for duty and was deployed to root out the Hamas fighters that day, according to a glowing profile in the Wall Street Journal. Bokazba, who spent 8 years in the Zionist regime's army for longer than the mandatory service requirement, has also participated in every war since 2005. He's also the chief executive of Venn, a company that makes software for large-scale residential landlords to manage, monitor, and extract maximum rents and revenue from tenants. It has received $100 million in venture capital, according to the Wall Street Journal. At least 15% of his employees also enlisted as reservists with the Zionist regime's military after the genocidal war on Gaza was declared. Another Zionist businessman, Iran Hagiag, is also named in the proposal. The Electronic Intifada learned Hagiag is a co-founder of Bokazba's company, Venn. Bokazba's proposal calls for the total destruction of northern Gaza and its reconstruction as a managed colony. Gaza, too, where Palestinians who behave according to the rules set by the Zionist regime will be allowed to stay. Those who misbehave will be expelled to a hellscape in southern Gaza, or, as he calls it, Gaza 1, the area of terror. The plan reads as a cross between Silicon Valley elevator pitch and the script for a science fiction horror movie. But to the extent it purports to be a real plan, it is not the first of its kind. In early 1990s, when the Oslo Accords were signed between the Zionist regime and the Palestine Liberation Organization, media hyped that Gaza would turn into a Singapore on the Mediterranean. Such notions were revived again after the child killer regime of Israel redeployed its occupation forces to the perimeter of Gaza in 2005 and then began imposing an ever-tightening siege. The condition behind these pie-in-the-sky promises, whether in Gaza or the West Bank, has always been that Palestinians surrender any hopes of self-determination and instead settle for economic crumbs, while the Zionist regime retains all real power over their lives. In the event, under the guise of peace process, the Zionist regime began to isolate Gaza and systematically de-develop its economy, as a scholar Sarah Roy describes. At the same time, it has accelerated its colonization of the West Bank, corralling Palestinians into ever-shrinking islands of land surrounded by a sea of Zionist settler colonies. Bakasba's vision is in this tradition, albeit with the nightmare softened by the cheerful language of a real estate broker and sprinkled with upbeat tech charlatanry. A week ago, I stood in Gaza watching the sunrise over a land destroyed by conflict, says his proposal submitted to the European firm in late November. Bakasba also claimed Gaza is a truly beautiful place with incredible views, beaches, and full of potential. He says of the killing fields where thousands of dead Palestinians still lie under the rubble of their homes and in makeshift mass graves. He claimed, "On October 7th, I put on my army uniform and in that moment I switched from being or the entrepreneur or the soldier, and I immediately started to think like a soldier again. You take orders and you execute. You can question the how, but not the why, not the big picture or the strategy. I realized that we all put on our army uniform on October 7th and started thinking like soldiers, especially our leaders," he claimed. While participating in the genocide and the bombing and shelling campaign described to be among the deadliest and most destructive in recent history, Bakasba dreamed of what to do on the ruins with the help of the US and certain Arab regimes in order to serve the Zionist regime's pipe dream of subduing Palestinian resistance once and for all. His plan would permanently partition northern and southern Gaza, respectively, into the area of hope and the area of terror. Bakasba hoped the Zionist regime would start implementing the so-called plan as soon as December 2023 and begin turning Gaza into the poster boy of hope for the Palestinian people. But that assumed that the Zionist regime would quickly defeat the Palestinian resistance and gain control of all or most of Gaza. That has not happened, however, as the resistance continues to inflict heavy losses on the Zionist regime's invaders in every part of Gaza. Meanwhile, according to the plan, the south will serve as a transition area for those awaiting relocation, an apparent endorsement of ethnic cleansing of those Palestinians who cannot prove their loyalty and utility to the Zionist regime. Residents of this imaginary plan would be recruited through inspiring brochures that we will drop in the millions from the sky, which will contain plan details and application procedures, he claimed. This plan does not explain how Palestinians displaced starving, dying of thirst, living with untreated injuries, illnesses and trauma, and cut off from communications, will submit their applications or why they would even consider trusting the fabricated regime of Israel. Bokasba claims applicants will commit to not having any association with terror groups and the residency will be revoked if they do. Bokasba describes a digital application process and a committee to determine who could live in the proposed Gaza 2 made up of Americans, Israelis, and Palestinian collaborators. He claimed, "One mistake and you are out to the old Gaza without a way to come back for a few years. Bringing together all the mindsets common to a landlord, prison ward, and colonizer." Bokasba is not shy that his motivation is entirely the Zionist regime's benefit. He claimed, "This is not altruism for the Palestinian people," adding that his so-called plan would be the biggest blow to resistance groups like Hamas. He calls for the Zionist regime government to begin implementing the project initially before turning it over to Palestinian collaborators under Israeli regime supervision similar to the Palestinian Authority in the occupied West Bank. Bokasba also hopes that a plan marketed as helping Palestinians will result in changing sentiment toward the Zionist regime in the international community for the better. Headlines would, he hopes, turn to "Israel brought a solution instead of Israel kills children." The fabricated regime of Israel has killed tens of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza during its genocide. The United Nations has acknowledged that most victims are women and children. Bokasba also markets his so-called plan as an effort to bring a success story, as he claimed, that will aid US President Joe Biden's re-election campaign.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on Imam Mehdi. Without Mehdawiyah, all efforts by all prophets will turn futile. July 9th, 2011. If Mehdawiyah did not exist, it would mean that all the efforts by divine prophets, all prophetic missions, all the strenuous efforts of divine prophets were futile. Therefore, the issue of Mehdawiyah is an essential issue. It is one of the central divine teachings. For this reason, as far as I know, in all divine religions, there are teachings which are essentially the equivalent to Mehdawiyah. However, these teachings have been distorted and blurred over time, and it is not clear what they are trying to say. The issue of Mehdawiyah is among the undeniable Islamic realities. That is to say, Mehdawiyah is not limited to Shia Islam. There is a consensus among all Islamic denominations on the end of the days, which includes when Imam Mehdi, may God hasten his reappearance, establishes ultimate justice in the world. There are valid narrations confirming that by the Holy Prophet and Islamic luminaries from different denominations of Islam. Therefore, there is no doubt in this regard. However, Shia Islam has an advantage among other denominations because the issue of Mahdawiya is not an ambiguous issue in Shia Islam. The issue of Mahdawiya is not a convoluted issue. It is not complicating to understand. It is clear. Mahdawiya has an epitome, and we are familiar with this epitome. We know his characteristics, we know his ancestors, we know his family. We know when he was born, we know the details, and this familiarity is not based on Shia narrations alone. There are non-Shia narrations that clarify the details for us. Followers of other Islamic denominations should pay careful attention in order to understand this clear truth.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The time after the reappearance of Imam Mahdi is the time the true rule of spirituality and religion over mankind's life. July 9th, 2011. The topic of Mahdawiya is among the main topics in the cycle and set of noble religious knowledges, such as the topic of prophethood. That is, it is comparable to prophethood. This is the importance that we should attach to the issue of Mahdawiya. Why? Because Mahdawiya represents what all prophets were sent for, namely, building a monotheistic world on the basis of justice, using all the capacities that Allah the Exalted has bestowed on humanity. This is the era that will come after the reappearance of Imam Mahdi. God's greetings be upon him, and may God hasten his reappearance. The era in which monotheism and genuine spirituality will be dominant over the entire life of human beings. The era in which justice will be established in the real sense of the word. Well, this was what prophets were sent for.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters. 9,650 kHz every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Local businesses expect German economy to shrink by 0.5% this year. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT wrote, German businesses expect the country's economy to contract by 0.5% this year, 2024, which would mark the second straight year of decline and the worst downturn in 20 years. A poll of over 27,000 companies carried out by the DIHK Chambers of Industry and Commerce revealed, of those surveyed, 35% expect business to deteriorate over the next 12 months, while only 14% expect an improvement. Meanwhile, 29% of respondents rated the current state of the business climate as good, while 22% expressed the opposite view. The 0.5% decline projected by DIHK poll contrasts with the German government's official projection of 0.2% growth. Germany has been hit by a severe crisis in recent years, as energy prices have surged, while a shortage of skilled workers and weak domestic demand weigh on the nation's economic performance. GDP declined by 0.3% year-on-year in 2023, making it the only G7 economy to shrink in 2023. The bad mood among companies is becoming more entrenched, the DIHK said, adding that if the poll's projection comes to pass, it would be only the second time in Germany's post-war history that the economy contracted for 2 years in a row. The country did face similar challenges back in 2002 and 2003, when two consecutive recessions forced Berlin to introduce aggressive labor market and welfare reforms that were credited with the elevating the competitiveness of the country's economy. DIHK head Martin Wanschbelen said in a statement, "This is a clear alarm signal that Germany and Europe must take seriously." The European Commission had previously issued a downbeat projection that Germany would be the biggest drag on EU growth in both 2023 and 2024, with modest gains of 0.3% in 2024 and 1.2% in 2025. Okay. According to Euronews, Piero Singari, market analyst, said Europe's economic powerhouse faces challenges of its own. He said Germany's economic sentiment indicators remain disconcerting, with January figures hitting lows not seen since the COVID-19 crisis, suggesting weak economic activity for half of 2024. After a 0.3% contraction in output in 2023, the German economy is only expected to see a modest increase of 0.3% in 2024, a downward revision from the 0.8% previously forecasted in autumn. The projection for 2025 remains constant at a growth of 1.2%. Singari also noted that labor shortages represent a bottleneck to economic activity, while a trade-driven recovery is also unlikely amid stagnating export and import dynamics, he said. On a more optimistic note, market financing conditions have eased recently, with expectations of continued relief facilitated by more accessible bank lending. According to CNBC, Germany's coalition government has been under pressure after going through a budget crisis following a decision from the Constitutional Court that the reallocation of unused debt taken on during the pandemic to current budget plans is unlawful. This left a 60 billion euro hole in the coalition's budget plans, and as the funds were allocated for years to come, the crisis is likely to rear its head again at the end of the year when 2025 budget planning begins. Voter satisfaction with the government is also low, with the opposition's CDU party currently leading in the polls and being followed in second place by Germany's far-right party, the AfD. Support for the latter has, however, declined in recent weeks amid protests against the far-right sweeping the country, with hundreds of thousands of Germans taking to the streets.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Shoppers at the popular Wuse market in Abuja, the Nigerian capital, are having tough times as skyrocketing rise in the prices of commodities has taken a heavy toll on ordinary people. Prices of commodities, especially food items, have gone up more than 100%, and indeed, they've continued to rise on a daily basis.
Cost of living is something else. It's terrible. A common man with a salary of 30,000 cannot buy a bag of rice of almost 80,000 naira.
There is hunger, terrible hunger, and I rise of stealing, thief, everything just keep going higher.
Bag of cement, it's like about 9,000, he just bought it. I said, wow, 9,000, where are we going? Bag of rice, 77,000.
Experts say, apart from the economic policy of devaluing the Nigerian currency, removal of multiple exchange rate windows has further weakened the naira against the dollar, resulting in inflation and harsh economic woes to the people. They said grinding poverty has created a sense of hopelessness in an already impoverished population, pushing many people to the edge.
IMF said we should devalue, we are devaluing. But what are the consequences of this on the economy, on the purchasing power parity that has even existed before now? We made money during the windfall when the price of oil was at its peak in the international oil market. But what did we do with this humongous amount that we made? It was frittered away through corruption.
Experts also said, at inception on 29 May 2023, the new government in Nigeria removed the subsidy on petrol, which pushed the prices of petrol up, resulting in the rise of goods and services, which further made things worse for the poor in Nigeria. But they said there are immediate solutions that can bring relief.
Nigeria is for Nigerians, so every Nigerian should benefit. So if the people want subsidy, they should reinstate that very particular subsidy. Or we fix our refineries. It's even dubious